Welcome to this windy, chilly Wednesday edition of Main Street here on member-supported Prairie Republic. I'm Craig Blumenschein. We'll do our best to warm you up a bit today. Later in the show, Dr. Tom Ezern is talking about turkeys. He'll trace the unlikely journey of turkeys from English markets to the Great Plains, culminating in the remarkable tale of a turkey drive from Omaha to Denver in 1863. And Dave Thompson and I will go over Governor Doug Burgum's budget presentation that he gave from the Capitol in Bismarck earlier today. But first, let's cook something warm and great together. We lead off with our newest edition of Prairie Plates.
I like bagels.
Have some salad.
All right, eat a pizza.
Eat some barbecue.
Apple sauce and some nice red beets.
There's the great music that we hear each and every Wednesday. It's our time to visit with our friend Rick Guillon here at Prairie Public. Rick, it's another edition of Prairie Plates. Welcome.
Good to be back with you, Craig, after a long Thanksgiving break.
It was wonderful. It was a very, very enjoyable break for me, and I hope it was for you and yours as well.
It was.
We have a guest in the Main Street studio. Greg Cook is with us. He's with 4E Winery, and he'll also tell us about his work at NDSU, where he's a chemistry professor, and also with his YouTube page that is gaining traction every day with 60,000 subscribers now, The Pot Thickens. So, Greg, welcome to you. Welcome to Main Street.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
I think that, Rick, you and I can kind of tag team our questions here today with Greg, if that's okay. And I'll start with the first one. Greg, give us the backstory. You're a vegan now. What inspired you to embrace the vegan cooking style and also everything that you do relative to that? Yeah.
Well, it kind of goes way back from when I was a kid, actually growing a garden in my backyard. I was always interested in foraging foods and local foods, even back when I was a kid and growing up in Michigan. And I think it really started there. That also is where my interest in making wine started, because I was figuring out how to preserve fruits when I was a kid. So what do? You ferment it. And so for a long time, I've been interested in whole foods and plant-based foods. Of course, I ate everything for a long time. About 8 years ago, I made the switch completely to try to do a plant-based diet, mainly because most of the processed foods and all the other foods like dairy and things were hard on my health. So it really was for health reasons.
Real quickly, have you noticed a change in your health?
Absolutely, yes. Less inflammation, which I think is largely due to dairy and meat.
Surprisingly, Craig, I actually eat healthy most of the time, but I do like to eat out a couple times a week, obviously, because I need to feed my page and also have fodder for this show. So,
sure.
Greg, the big question for me is, what did you make for Thanksgiving?
Ah, for Thanksgiving. You know, there's a lot of vegans out there, plant-based eaters, that try to fake the meats, which is fine. I'm happy that they have the tofurkies and things for them. I can make some pretty good imitation meats, but I went for just something savory and rich and comfortable. I made a very rich mushroom bourguignon stew and mashed potatoes.
That sounds very good. Did you have some of that 4E wine that you also make with that?
It was, yes, both in the stew and on the table.
I want to ask a follow-up question to this wine gig. You're a kid making, figuring out how to make wine. Kid and wine, is there any connection there we should be aware of?
I didn't drink the wine when I was a kid or make it then, although my parents let me dabble a little bit in trying to ferment some things. It didn't turn out well. But I would go to the library and just pour through those home winemaking books and learn about the process of making wine and the fermentation.
You have this YouTube page called The Pot Thickens.
Yes.
Give us the whole backstory and tell us what you want to accomplish with that.
Well, yeah, and I love cooking. I've been cooking for a long time. I grew up watching, you know, The Frugal Gourmet and Julia Childs and, of course, all of the Food Network shows. So I really learned visually how to cook from all of that. And then, you know, COVID hit in 2020, and everyone, when I would post a picture on Facebook or social media, they'd say, "What's the recipe? What's the recipe?" And I thought, well, I don't have recipes. I just cook. So I just started taking videos, and I created the YouTube channel in 2020.
What is your favorite thing to make, or what is your favorite thing on that YouTube page?
Well, there's quite a number of different dishes on there, and you'll notice if you go there that I do have a lot of more ethnic themed, Asian themed foods, because I find they're very amenable to plant-based cooking. The thing that really made my channel blow up, I would say, is showing the process, actually a centuries old process, to take flour, wheat, and remove the starch and just be left with the protein and make a like a chicken-like product.
And that's called seitan.
Seitan,
right?
Yes.
And what does that taste like? Just describe it a little bit.
Well, like chicken, it tastes like whatever you season it with. I mean, it has a little bit of a protein flavor. It's kind of a neutral flavor. Of course, if you season it with all of the flavorings of the umami richness, whatever you want to put in there, you can make barbecue, you can make, you know, whatever.
And I've noticed slicing it up and putting it on sandwiches. And talk a little bit about that.
Yes. I do this for my restaurant at Forey Winery. We make a kind of a deli meat type of style of seitan. It's actually a mixture of both tofu and flour protein in it. And it's seasoned with poultry seasonings and things to make it taste like a deli turkey.
And I've had your banh mi sandwiches out there, and those are really good. But talk a little bit about the process there, too, because you make the bread and pickle the vegetables, grow the vegetables. It's kind of vertically integrated. Just discuss that a little bit.
Yeah. So for me, you know, I find a lot of processed foods and even restaurant foods, they tend to be highly processed and manufactured to be shipped and go a long way. I like to make things from scratch as much as I can. So, yeah, if you can get some carrots and daikon and julienne them up and pickle them, put that on the banh mi, that's great. You get that nice pickle note, freshly pickled vegetables. You can bake bread. Is pretty easy to make. It's just flour, water, and salt and yeast. Nothing better than a fresh baked bread. So all the commercial breads have lots of stabilizers and preservatives in them that aren't really the best things to be eating.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Cook, I'll say Dr. Cook because your day job is a chemistry professor at NDSU. What do students say when they Google you? They got to figure out who this guy is who's going to be teaching my chemistry class. And then they figure out, holy smokes.
Oh, yeah.
This guy knows how to cook. Yeah.
Well, you know, chemistry is cooking, really, in a way, I guess. Students, you know, they can sometimes be a little intimidated by the professor, you know, and they're scared to come and talk to the professor because they kind of put us on a different level. And I think what happens there is, like, they see that I'm a real person and I'm a human just like them. And it actually makes a better connection for them in the classroom. They are more at ease. They're more open to learning. And some of them are very curious about the way I cook so that I can make delicious food that happens to be just based on plants.
Have you got any students excited about the plant-based eating?
Well, I know there are students who are a vegan or plant-based that come up to me and say, oh, I found your channel. Thanks so much for showing me how to do that. So, yeah.
So you like to grow a lot of the things that you use, and you make your own tortillas. Is that hard to do?
It is. It's a lot of work. So I mentioned I grew up watching the TV shows, cooking shows and things, but I'm a visual learner. And so the great thing about the modern day is YouTube has such amazing tutorials on making anything. I learned how to make tortillas from channels from Mexico, from the abuela, grandmothers, grinding corn on the stone metates. So I bought a metate, I grew the corn, I nixtamalize it, and I do it. It's a lot of work. So I don't do that every day.
Sounds delicious, though. What about tofu? You've been making tofu lately.
Yeah, I've been dabbling in making my own tofu, which is not that difficult of a process. A lot of people who are plant-based or vegan often make their own nut milks, like almond milk and things like that. It's just basically soy milk, and you add a coagulant. It's like making cheese in a way. Like you just make the soy milk. You add the coagulant, it coagulates, you scoop it out, and you strain it in a cheesecloth and press it, and you have tofu.
Greg Cook, he's with Fargo 4E Winery. He's a chemistry professor at NDSU, and he also has a YouTube cooking page called The Pot Thickens with almost 60,000 subscribers. You're a vegan, Greg. So to me, I go back to this wine business that you're in. Wine and food pairing to me is always, what wine do you serve with this steak? What wine do you serve with this seafood? How does wine and food pairing work with vegan dishes?
It's just food. Vegan dishes are food. And many dishes that people eat are naturally vegan. They just don't think about it or call it or label it vegan. Another appetizer I did at Thanksgiving was a dish called farinata. It's an Italian flatbread just made from chickpeas and water and salt and olive oil. That's it. It's so delicious. It's naturally vegan. And you can pair a wine with that. You know, you get that rich, toasty note. You pair a nice, crisp white wine with that. It's, you know, it's the same things you think about pairing with any food. The flavors have to complement the wine. We can do a whole nother show on wine pairing if you want.
That sounds good.
That would be good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you were just in Spain, too, and yes. I noticed some photos because you and I are friends on social media. And talk a little bit about some of the foods you tried there. They really looked good.
Oh, Spain is wonderful. And Barcelona, you know, that region of Spain is famous for its own version of tapas. The small dishes that you get when you go out to the restaurants have a little glass of cava, the sparkling wine from Spain, and some fresh tapas. One of the regional dishes, which I fell in love with, is they just take bread and they toast it. You rub it with a garlic clove. You squeeze on a juicy fresh tomato and rub that into the little olive oil and salt. That's it. It's bread with tomato.
It's kind of like Spanish bruschetta.
Yes, and it's delicious and simple.
So have you made any of these dishes back at home now? Have you tried?
Yes, I've been making that a lot because I'm now starting to bake this Spanish pan de cristal, this bread that's almost like a ciabatta, but the Spanish version of ciabatta. It's perfect for making that dish.
Greg, is there anything that you've tried and are working on but you just can't get it the way that you want it?
Yes, vegan cheeses. I mean, I make a pretty good cheese sauce, but it's really hard to get that melty cheese. There are some artisan cheese makers that are doing fermented, really cheese-like making processes using cashews and other things. It's really hard to find in this area because they're really specialized shops. Like, you'll find them in California and other places, but it's hard to make things that will match cheese. And I have to say, for those who go plant-based, that's probably the number one roadblock to people going completely vegan. But that's okay. Dairy is a problem for me, but many people can eat dairy without a problem.
Back to the Spanish foods, I've noticed, like, you making a big paella.
Ah, paella, yes. Paella I've been making for a while, and you can do that. Paella is the Spanish dish with rice. You cook it in a big flat pan, usually over a fire, is sort of traditional. I just don't add meat. I use lots of vegetables. Mushrooms are a good substitute because it has lots of umami richness that adds to a dish. So I usually use some kind of mushroom in it.
With not having dairy in your products, are desserts tough for you to come up with?
They are, and to be honest, I don't eat a lot of desserts, but I can make some good desserts, and I have. And I usually opt for things that can use, so I don't have to substitute milk too much. I usually use a lot of coconut milk for richness in desserts, especially creamy desserts. I made a pumpkin coconut milk pudding for dessert for Thanksgiving, actually, and it was really good.
Anything for Christmas coming up here that you're kind of brainstorming about?
Yeah, I haven't planned yet for Christmas. I got to work on that. It's coming too fast.
It really is. Greg, for someone who's new to vegan cooking or even homemade food preparation like you talked about earlier, what's the first dish that might be a good idea for them to try or a certain technique that you'd like to recommend?
If you think about what I eat on a daily basis, in terms of vegan or plant-based eating, I try to incorporate proteins. People are scared of tofu. But if you just take tofu, just dust it with a little corn flour, you know, corn starch, sear it in a pan, put on a nice sweet and sour sauce. You could even use a bottled Chinese sweet and sour sauce or a little of that, my favorite, Lao Gan Ma chili crisp. Toss it with that and just eat that. I think it's simple and it's delicious. But pastas, you know, I love spaghetti. I love spaghetti with tomato sauce. You know, that's naturally vegan if you don't add meat to it.
What's the pace of videos that you try to keep up with on your YouTube page? And how do you decide when and what you're going to talk about?
That's a good question. I'm way behind right now. The channel has been growing for a while without me adding to it lately. I have a good set of videos there now that I did early on. Work and the winery have been interfering with my editing schedule. So if I can give up some of my responsibilities at work, I might be able to do more editing here soon. But I have lots of plans and I have lots of notes on new dishes to try.
Your most popular video, is it the tomato sauce from tomato pasta sauce?
You know, that is surprisingly one of the more popular videos, making tomato sauce from fresh tomatoes and canning it. It's actually my second most popular one. The first one is the washing the flour to make seitan.
I don't know. I've watched quite a few of those videos and I've picked up some tips, and obviously I'm not people that have listened to this show before, I'm not vegan, but I do like healthy eating. You know, usually doctors just say like, well, you just eat more fruits and vegetables. Well, that's a good suggestion, but it doesn't have a lot of flavor, you know, and so are there any like introductory foods that maybe people are not so afraid of, I guess?
So I actually go to pastas when I think about this, because pastas are so easy to make. You can take any kind of noodle, any kind of pasta, mix it with whatever sauce you want. The best is, you know, you take inspiration from Italian cooking, which is simple. And sometimes there's meat in it and sometimes they're not. Just take one day a week and have meatless meals that day. Mm-hmm. You know, make a pasta alla puttanesca, just simple tomato and black olives, and stir it with some linguine noodles.
Minus the anchovies.
Minus the anchovies, yes. Yeah,
but it still can be good without anchovies.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, it's just, to me, it just food needs to have some flavor. I like those bold flavors, and so those are very good suggestions.
Yeah, one of the things I think about when I'm cooking is how do I replace the richness and that depth of savory flavors in foods that oftentimes meat and other things provide. And I mentioned mushrooms, but, you know, there's soy, fermented soy things like miso, a little bit of miso paste, a little bit of soy sauce. Those can add some rich depth to a dish.
Greg, don't judge me.
Okay.
But one of my favorite books is Meathead. Mm-hmm. It's The Science of Great Barbecue and Grilling. And I ask you that because I refer to it often. But what I find so cool about it is, like you said earlier, this all comes down to science and chemistry.
Yes.
Even the great, you know, smokers or the great brisket makers or the barbecuers will or should understand that. And there's some unbelievable science behind the interaction of heat with foods, with the interaction of spices with foods. Is there a similar book that you would like to recommend for folks that are wanting to have a more vegan lifestyle that also talks about how salt penetrates, how other spices don't? When to cook, how much to cook, et cetera.
Boy, you know, there's quite a few vegan cookbooks out there now that describe things like there are books just focused on various vegan meat dishes and like seitan and how to prepare those and how to flavor them. But to be honest, I don't cook a lot from cookbooks, so I don't have a good recommendation. I devour YouTube videos from across the world and try to learn about their food.
Where would you like to take your YouTube channel? What would you like, if you could just dedicate your life to that, what would you like to do with it?
Oh, I would like it to be a source for inspiration for people to get over their fear of cooking, because I think if you're going to eat whole foods, plant-based, even if you're not vegan, you want to eat things that are less processed. That means learning how to cook at home and getting those techniques just to learn how to cook without worrying about following a recipe specifically. I think that's what would be good.
Do you have a favorite place to eat in North Dakota or even in Fargo-Moorhead area that really caters to vegans, that really do a great, great job?
There are a few places that I would recommend. And I tend to go towards the Asian restaurants. The Thai restaurants in town are all terrific. Lila Thai and Sri Rat Thai House and the Thai Orchid, they're all great. I'm probably missing some. If you're looking for fine dining, I think Mezzaluna and Rustica, those are my two go-tos because they always have a fantastic plant-based dish on the menu. A lot of restaurants, I'll be honest, think about the vegetarian or vegan option as an afterthought, and there's not a lot of thought put into it. And so I really like those two places for fine dining because they really think about that dish and make it spectacular.
I think another one is Soho 23.
Yes.
That has that gin with it, and she just does a really great job with the Korean.
Yeah,
angle.
I was going to mention that too because that's one of my absolute favorites.
Yeah, that
she does a wonderful tofu bibimbap in that stone bowl, like really traditional bibimbap. It's just a rice dish, crispy rice. Oh, so good.
Yeah, the heated bowl that makes that crispy rice. That's really, really good.
Very Korean. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, and Greg posts on my Fargo-Moorhead Eats Facebook group, which has a little over 42,000 followers now, not quite 60, which you have on your YouTube page. But what are some of the reactions you see off of that page? I do see a lot of positive comments. There are some people that are vegan food, whatever. But for the most part, I see some very positive comments. And so Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, so and I'm convinced that if we just get rid of the labels and all the negative intonations of a label, we look at food and look at what it is. And delicious food is delicious food. And if you have a good photo of it that presents it well, it's even better. And people look at what I make and don't if there's no label on it, they don't think twice. They say, oh, that looks great. Sometimes if that vegan label is on it, you get some negative reactions. But those are rare.
Rick, real quickly, Greg, what is the E in 4E? Where did that come from?
That's a great question. It stands for four elements, earth, fire, water, and air. It's kind of the theme of our winery. And it's a double entendre also to my chemistry career as well.
Greg Cook, he lives in Fargo, and he's with 4E Winery. He's also a chemist. He teaches chemistry at North Dakota State University. He also has a YouTube page called The Pot Thickens with almost 60,000 subscribers. And he's been our guest today on Prairie Plates. Greg, it has been a great, great pleasure for us.
Yeah, for me too. Thank you.
Main Street continues with another episode of Plainsfolk. Dr. Tom Easern delves into the fascinating history of turkey culture and transport, inspired by Gordon Eisenminger's book, The All-American Turkey Show. With a rich blend of historical insight and storytelling, Easern traces the unlikely journey of turkeys from English markets to the Great Plains, culminating in the remarkable tale of a turkey drive from Omaha to Denver in 1863. This is a story of ingenuity, endurance, and the enduring legacy of a bird that once made Grand Forks the turkey capital of the world.
Gordon Eisenminger, professor of history emeritus at the University of North Dakota, over his long and distinguished career has exemplified wonderfully the old adage, cast down your bucket where you are. A specialist in British history, he has turned his attention to matters at hand. People know him for his fine essays on German-Russian culture in McIntosh County and for his splendid work, The Quartzite Border, about the origins of the stone markers that line the North Dakota-South Dakota boundary. Now comes the All-American Turkey Show, when Grand Forks, North Dakota, was the turkey capital of the world, 1924 to 1943, published by North Dakota State University Press. The book treats all things turkey-ish, with focus on the commodity culture centered in Grand Forks in the 1920s and 1930s. But right now, with Gordon's help, I want to talk about turkey drives. Turkeys travel well, historically, indigenous to America and domesticated prior to the arrival of European colonization. They sailed back to Spain with the colonizers and were raised and eaten there in the 1520s. By the 1550s, they were providing protein to the Scandinavians. It's uncertain just how and when they came to England, but we know Henry VIII relished turkey. Thereafter, English cities grew, creating central demand for meat, while drovers held an established niche as deliverers of same in the form of lamb and beef. Why not turkeys then? Well, because they had no hooves and their feet got sore. Drovers tried putting little booties on them, but that was tedious. The solution was to drive the flock through soft tar, next through loose sand, and then hit the road with them. Gordon's chops as a British historian serve him well as he uses Daniel Defoe and other venerable sources to chart the rise of Suffolk and Norfolk as the sources of birds destined for London's Smithfield market. He takes us with Defoe to Stratford to count the birds taken across the toll bridge, 300 to 1,000 in a flock, totaling 150,000 in a fall season. Transport evolved to meet demand, first with the devisement of horse-drawn turkey wagons, four-story coops built up and out from a wagon base lumbering toward London. Then, to answer the seasonal crunch at Christmas, the stuffing of coaches with turkey carcasses, displacing passengers and all cargo but the mails. So when English colonists brought their Norfolk blacks to America, turkey culture and turkey transport were established arts. Turkey drives specifically, however, reached an apex on the Great Plains in 1863, which Gordon explains. And I also have a recently discovered primary account by a participant in a great turkey drive from Omaha to Denver. Three chaps in Omaha named Bruffy, Hurd, and Miller gathered a flock out of Iowa and drove them out Farnham Street and west up the Platte. The birds walked by day with two fellows named Reckmeyer and Swobe pushing them from behind. By night, they roosted in a turkey wagon, similar to those described in England, a double-decker coupe mounted on a wagon with the bed below stocked with cracked corn. They lost a few birds to coyotes in western Nebraska, but came through to Denver with 150 turkeys that sold for $12 or $15 apiece, worth the trouble. The drive commenced on the 25th of April and concluded on the 29th of May. But I have not concluded with the subject of the All-American Turkey Show, to which I will return.
That was Tom Ezern, our longtime friend and distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University. Coming after the break, our news director Dave Thompson will stop by the Main Street studio to discuss Governor Burgum's 2025-27 executive budget address that he gave live from the House chamber in the North Dakota State Capitol this morning. That's after this. Main Street continues on this cold and chilly Wednesday. I'm Craig Blumenschein, pleased to be joined by Dave Thompson. He's our news director here at Prairie Public. Welcome back to Main Street, Dave.
Thanks, Craig. Good to be here.
Dave, Governor Burgum delivered his final budget address to the North Dakota legislature today. Mm-hmm. You were there. He reflected on his 8 years in office. Then he outlined his vision for the 2025-2027 biennium. The governor highlighted the state's fiscal stability, workforce challenges, housing needs, continued investment in education, and infrastructure as key priorities. We're going to cover about seven of his key topics here in just a minute. But he began, really, Dave, with a statement that it's obvious. The state is in fiscally good shape.
Yeah, the state is in good shape. And remember, when you're talking about after the great drought of the late 1990s, when the state was really having to cut back on a lot of things and raise income taxes in order to make a balanced budget. And then when he came into office, he did have to reduce the general fund budget from his predecessor. But since that time, the state's been doing well. We've got decent oil. We've got decent crops. We have a lot of expanding workforce in North Dakota in terms of we've got expanding industries. We've got new industries coming in. They want to come into the state of North Dakota because, as he said it, it's a favorable tax climate. And, you know, if you can get workers up here, then that's a win-win.
The overall budget, including federal funds, Dave, he mentioned, would be about $19.6 billion, slightly below the current biennium. And he also noted, and I think this is important, that there are no transfers from the state's Bank of North Dakota or other funds needed to balance this budget. And he also, Dave, made the point, which should again be obvious, that reserve funds are at record levels. Expand on that for just a moment, if you would.
Yeah. Now, this has been an effort between Governor Burgum and the legislature to have these rainy day funds available. And it's a way to lock some things off instead of people trying to overspend things. So they've got a decent amount of rainy day funds. Say something collapses tomorrow, the state can dive into the SIF fund or dive into some of the other trust funds that are out there, and they can bring some money out and make things whole without much pain.
Dave, he often talked about workforce development and how important it has been for our state and how it remains a top barrier for economic growth. Mm-hmm. He proposed investments, including $53.8 million for workforce incentives and automation tax credits. He used welders as an example for that to boost productivity. Tell me more about those incentives.
Well, yeah, this was started just a few years ago. And he said what we ought to do is we want to bring these firms in that they can do some of these things with automation, not necessarily to prevent workers from having to come to there, but to do some of the routine things with automation. He said, you know, we can attract industries, and apparently this is starting to really, you know, take off in North Dakota. We're seeing a lot more of it.
He really lauded the success of childcare programs to date.
said he added 1,000 slots and supported 6,400 children, but he called for continued funding for childcare infrastructure. Most everyone agrees it's still a big problem here in the state.
Absolutely. You talk to anybody and you talk to business owners. They said, yes, we just offered a job to somebody down in Iowa. They'd like to come, but they can't. And they can't bring their family because there aren't childcare slots available. And you know that it's more prevalent that they're not available in cities that are smaller like Hillsboro or Mayville or something like that. But also in the big cities, childcare is at a premium, and that has been a barrier to getting people to come and fill the open jobs that are in North Dakota. We've got a lot of open jobs.
Dave, he reinforced his commitment to using legal immigration to support the workforce. He said, essentially, our harvest would not happen without legal immigrants coming to the state.
That's right. It's harvest, but also oil workers. Remember that they had a program to bring Ukrainians to northwestern North Dakota to work in the oil fields. So these are all legal immigrants. They have been vetted. They have been gone through the process. And they really want to step this up because you're looking at some of the other things like Applied Digital and some of the other industries that are looking to locate in a state like North Dakota. Again, friendly tax climate. They need the people. And the state has agreed that legal immigration is one way to fill that gap.
Dave, the governor also talked about the housing crisis. He used the same story. Hey, I'd like to offer this person from out of state a job, come to North Dakota. And the response has been, more often than not, sure, but we can't find a place to live. And he highlighted the need for 20,000 new housing units statewide to support workforce growth. And he proposed $95 million in a housing package that would include $30 million for the Housing Incentive Fund and strategies to reduce them regulatory burdens. He says it's too expensive to build here, and regulatory burdens are the problem.
There are a lot of things at play there, Craig. One thing that has been kind of overlooked is that, you know, there's an effort now among state government to look at building codes, not only statewide building codes, but local building codes, and see if there could be some updates and maybe some improvements to make it easier to build this housing that is necessary. So watch for that to roll out in the next few months.
Dave, one of the most interesting proposals that he talked about was a $50 million investment or a proposal for the educational savings accounts to give families greater school choice and then flexibility, not just for school, but also maybe for better supporting extracurricular activities and things like that.
I was very interested in that because I'd heard him discuss it previously. And in a briefing that we as media had, he talked about that and he said, there's a need for this. And one thing he talked about was in-place charter schools. Say you have a public school, but you might have a public charter school. So there are a lot of things at play and a lot of ideas that are coming out. It'll be interesting to see how this works. I don't know how it's going to roll out yet. I think the legislature is going to have some say in how it rolls out.
Dave, higher education also was on the governor's mind. He's committed to reform there and proposed to address demographic and technological changes, and he emphasized innovation and alignment with workforce needs. What was the response or the thought about his comments about higher education?
It's interesting because he also brought up something that he brought up 2 years ago. He would like to reform the Board of Higher Education and make different boards for different brands of colleges. For example, there would be a board that would oversee the two-year college, a board that would oversee the normal four-year colleges, and a board that would oversee the research universities, UND and NDSU. Didn't meet with a lot of support in the last legislative session, but he says this is a way to, you know, to get more focus on what the state needs and have boards that are closer to their brands of institutions. I'm going to be interested to see how that's going to roll out because higher education has been kind of a, I don't know what you would call it per se, but there's been some questioning of the Board of Higher Education in the legislature. So see how that goes.
Dave, this next issue that I want to talk with you about is tax policy. And I just visited with my wife about this. I think this will be the most high traffic website perhaps developed if the state follows through with this $5 million initiative to make property taxes more transparent. What the governor proposed to do was to make this website, you type in your address, and then you see exactly how you're taxed from the park board, from the school board, et cetera, and click again, or maybe it's just right there in big letters, every board member's name and phone number.
Mm-hmm.
So call them up. Don't call the legislature. He said, call up these guys if you're concerned about how property taxes are rising in the state. What was your takeaway from that?
I found it kind of interesting. Now, the governor has had a consistent philosophy that property taxes are levied by local governments, and the legislature really can't do anything except maybe pour some more money into subsidizing K-12 education, or maybe doing something for local park boards, or having more of a financial sharing authority with local governments. But he is taking more of an initiative now, saying, okay, I don't think the legislature should be involved in doing this. You should go right to the local government, find out why your property taxes is going up, and have that all transparent. And then maybe you can go to the meetings where they roll out, you know, these are meetings that are required. County commissions normally hold them. They roll out property tax meetings to try to tell people where your property taxes are going. But this is another way for people to get involved and maybe sound off on it.
He singled out park facilities. Did you find that surprising?
I did, to an extent. I really did. Park facilities, of all things. But, you know, he is talking about making North Dakota a destination state. And early on, when he started talking about the Main Street Initiative, he did talk about the modern employee wants a family experience, and family experience including, you know, like theaters or having a vibrant downtown. It includes park facilities. And he's been a big booster of that, as you see with the Walhalla, the new Walhalla State Park, and all the improvements that are going into Theodore Roosevelt that the state's paying for.
He did call for continued efforts to eliminate the state income tax. Dave, in your crystal ball, do you see that happening this year? And he used it in the context of, hey, we've got to be like Alaska and Wyoming, and as we compete for energy workers, we need to be able to tell them, hey, you don't have an income tax here in this state. And he also used the example of someone who's stationed in Grand Forks at the Air Force Base saying, hey, I'm a North Dakota resident. Right now, he says, they say they're Texas residents because they don't have income tax.
You know, it's interesting you ask if this might be accomplished this year. I know there's a group of legislators who are really working hard on making sure that does happen. But there are other legislators who you talk to and say, you could go knock on people's doors. They're not talking about the income tax. They're talking about the property tax. So really, if you're talking about tax reform, property tax is going to be number one on the minds of legislators. But I do think there will be a discussion, probably a healthy one, about whether or not North Dakota can get by with eliminating a state income tax.
Dave, the governor talked about tribal relations, and in a very positive way, he praised enhanced collaboration with North Dakota's five tribal nations. He talked about gaming compacts, law enforcement agreements, shared revenue initiatives, and he urged the legislature to really build on that momentum. What does that mean?
Well, I'll tell you that, you know, Governor Bergen has done a very good job reaching out to tribal governments, and they have come up with a number of agreements, a number of compacts, a number of handshakes about what's going on. But Bergen will no longer be in office, so he wants the legislature and the new governor, Kelly Armstrong, to further that and see if we can come up with more agreements. And especially, you know, there's some been focused lately on law enforcement and who has what jurisdiction on the reservations. I think that will be an issue that will be revisited.
Governor opened his speech and then later on talked about it relative to economic growth, about how North Dakota is a desired place to live and is leading the nation in many, many relevant categories. Expand on that, Dave, if you would.
It is what a change from when we were losing population a lot. And North Dakota used to be number one in terms of out-migration. Now it looks like we're number one in terms of in-migration. And part of the reason is that we're making the state more, you know, more affordable, more accessible. You know, families want to live here now. And he has done a lot with economic development to bring this about. Now we have a very low out-migration rate and a good in-migration rate. We have a happy state. We've been one of the happiest states in the union for a number of years. And he says it's all because our attitudes are changing and we're more welcoming to outsiders. And people do want to move here because they see industries. And again, I'm going to talk about, you know, these data centers. That's a big growing industry, we think. And there's a lot of effort in commerce to attract more data centers to North Dakota. And that goes into another issue about power. He did talk mm-hmm. about that. And I didn't mean to preempt you, Craig, but he did talk about the need for more baseload power. And there's a lot of discussion on that. I honestly think the legislature is going to be looking at what they can do for some of these smaller, more portable nuclear plants. They've got one that's going up in Saskatchewan very soon. And the Department of Commerce is all in on that. We probably need to look at nuclear because nuclear, with all its issues, is a clean burning fuel.
Dave, how did the legislature embrace this speech?
Everyone I talked to said they really liked what he had to say, and they appreciated that he was giving the legislature a lot of kudos as well. And they say the challenge is to take it forward. And talking to the majority leaders of both houses, they said, you know, we did have our differences. We're not going to agree on everything, but we agreed on a lot of things, and we agreed on frameworks and overreaching concepts. And I think that's a big thing because if you know Governor Burgum, he talks about concepts and overreaching and, you know, what you want to accomplish, what the goals are. And it's how you get there where you might have some bumps in the road.
Davey got emotional a couple times that I noticed, first in the front of his speech and then at the end. You could tell he realized that this was the last time he was going to be doing this here in the state of North Dakota. He reflected on his tenure and his legacy, and I think it's going to be a positive one.
I believe that overall it is going to be a positive one. I mean, there's a lot of things that have happened under his 8 years in office that if you were living here in the late 60s, early 70s, you'd probably think, nah, that's never going to happen. But it has happened. And, you know, he does deserve a good share of the credit for that, but he worked hand in hand with legislators to make that happen.
Dave, let's look ahead now. Tell us the roadmap of what happens next. Governor Burgum gave the legislature his thoughts in a budget,
uh-huh.
and now he leaves office. Kelly Armstrong will become North Dakota's next governor. What happens next? What if Mr. Armstrong doesn't agree with everything that Governor Burgum proposed?
Well, that's interesting because the new governor is going to get a chance to weigh in on what has happened. I mean, there are probably going to be some issues where there are going to be some changes, maybe some tweaks in the focus, so to speak. And I don't doubt that Kelly Armstrong will be involved in those discussions because, you know, he came from a legislative background. They all know him. Mm-hmm. They all like him. And he has been one who has been willing to say, okay, let's compromise. So, you know, he's going to be an interesting person to watch in this upcoming legislative session.
All right, Dave, before I let you go, we have about a minute and a half left here. We know that property tax is going to be top of mind with the legislature. Give me two more topics that are going to be on their plate that maybe they'll struggle to come to conclusion with.
Well, one I think is going to be that education trust fund or that education savings fund that he was talking about. I think that will be a lot that will be discussed. I also think that maybe some of these workforce initiatives might hit some bumps in the road just because how much can you do? And I think that overall, though, the Burgum's message today really hit good notes with most of the legislators.
Is this the final thing we're going to hear from the legislature this year? Is it all now going to really ramp up after the first of the year? Or are there a couple other things this calendar year that we should watch for?
Probably not at this point, but I think it's going to be, there's a budget section meeting, of course, and they're just going to go over some of the from Moody's Analytics, what the future revenue holds. They're going to look at that. And then they have to marry that with what can they do with the budget that was proposed. And that's when Kelly Armstrong comes in January. He gives a State of the State address to a legislature in January, and he actually takes office on the 15th of December. So he'll have a chance with his new OMB director to sit down and take a look at if there needs to be tweaks in the budget.
Dave Thompson, he's Prairie Public's longtime news director. Dave, I bet you don't know off the top of your head how many budget addresses you've been to in the legislature. Have you tallied that up?
Oh, good grief. I haven't yet. Give me an abacus. Maybe I can do it.
An abacus. All right. Well, we'll look forward to you learning to use an abacus first, Dave. All he's right. Our news director. We're glad he's with us. Thanks for joining us today on Main Street.
Thank you, Craig.
More Main Streets ahead. Stay with us.
Support is provided by Drs. Kirk Coyer and Phil Sondrel of Urgent Med, providing personalized walk-in medical care for all ages 7 days a week in South Fargo. Urgent Med, where urgent care doesn't feel like urgent care.
This is Dakota Datebook for December 4th. North Dakotans were both alarmed and annoyed by a crime spree in 1925. People kept an eye out for anyone who looked suspicious. In November, thieves visited the turkey farm of A.L. Orange, just outside of Jamestown. When neighbors returning from town noticed a suspicious car parked by the farm, they acted. The car sped off at high speed, and the neighbors followed, resulting in a high-speed chase that reached 50 miles per hour. The chasers got close enough to obtain the license plate number and a description of the getaway car. They shared the information with law enforcement, but the thieves managed to escape with 9 turkeys. This wasn't the last turkey theft of the year. On this date, in 1925, readers of the Bismarck Tribune learned of another turkey theft, but this time the thief didn't get away. A call came into the Bismarck Sheriff's Office on the night of December 2nd. William Lukes, who lived about 7 miles from Bismarck, reported that someone was stealing his turkeys. The sheriff, his deputy, and a city patrolman hurried to the farm. Upon arrival, they noticed footprints in the snow. Following the tracks, they found a key with a turkey inside. More footprints led away from the car, so the officers followed them. At 8 o'clock the next morning, they found Adolf Miller and immediately arrested him. Justice came quickly for Miller. The following day, he was arraigned before Justice of the Peace Roland H. Crane on a charge of turkey theft and pleaded guilty. He was fined $20 and ordered to pay court costs of $80. The sheriff was disappointed by the outcome. He regretted that Miller received such a minor punishment, noting that stealing turkeys was a serious crime and should have more serious consequences. The sheriff believed Miller should have been sentenced to a year in prison, but current law did not allow for that. Turkeys are still raised in North Dakota today. There are 9 turkey farms in the state, producing about 1 million turkeys each year. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Ann Alquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
And that's a wrap for this Wednesday edition of Main Street. Thank you so much for joining us. We're deeply grateful that you spent time with us. Tomorrow on the show, we'll host Matt Olean for his weekly movie review. He'll give us his comments about Gladiator 2. Dave Thompson and I will review the news of the week, and we'll check in on the Emmy Award-winning Concordia Christmas Concert. It's a regional holiday highlight during the holiday season, featuring choirs and orchestra performing in front of a newly created mural every year. This year's concerts will feature more than 300 student musicians and 5 ensembles. That's all tomorrow on Main Street, and we hope you'll join us again.